This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
It's pretty terrifying to see your baby struggling to breathe and showing signs of distress.
This was Sunday, October 23rd. Just one day before, Caitlin Laycock had noticed that her infant son, named Cope, and just 3 weeks old, wasn't breathing quite right.
We took him Saturday morning to the doctor, and his lungs were clear. Everything was fine. By Sunday morning, we started to see some of those signs, RSV signs. You know, you're looking for the labored breathing and retractions with their stomach, and kind of you can see it in their neck, and flared nostrils is like a pretty big sign of labored breathing.
RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus. It's a well-known, extremely common virus. So common that the Mayo Clinic says almost every child gets infected with RSV by the time they turn 2. So most of the time, parents hardly notice, because RSV usually behaves much like the common cold. And Caitlin, by the way, has had all sorts of normal experiences with runny noses and fevers and mild coughs. She's also got an older son, a toddler who's 2.5, and she's a first grade teacher too. But an RSV infection behaves differently in newborn babies and older adults. For them, it can be dangerous. Each year in the United States, 58,000 to about 80,000 children under the age of 5 are hospitalized from RSV, and up to 300 die. But again, that's known and normal for this disease. But this year, RSV seems like it's anything but normal. As Saturday turned to Sunday in the Laycock household, little Cope got very sick.
At about 5 o'clock Sunday morning, we started to see some of those. And then we went to our pediatrician by about 9:15. And when we got there, they ended up calling an ambulance and putting oxygen on him right away because he was having such a hard time breathing. Obviously, really frightening at first. I've never ridden an ambulance before and didn't think it would be with my 3-week-old.
Caitlin, her husband, and Cope were taken to Wake Med Children's Emergency Department in Raleigh, North Carolina. It was packed.
The hospital is just so overwhelmed with cases right now that we were in the emergency room for about 24 hours before we were actually able to be moved to the pediatric floor of our hospital because they just didn't have any rooms. They're, from what the nurses and the doctors told us, they're just totally overrun with cases, mostly RSV. I think when we got to the emergency room, our nurse told us they had 22 patients in the emergency room at that time, and 15 of them were RSV cases.
They waited 24 hours, as you heard. And Caitlin and her husband were not alone. So many other families were also waiting.
I know when we were in the emergency room, we saw there were patients in the hallway. I mean, on beds in the hallway. And, you know, you think about something, you might go to the emergency room that you need to be seen right away. And then you get there and there's a 5-hour wait time. I mean, I know obviously they take based on need, but it has to be scary to go to get the medical care you need. And you're sitting in the emergency room for hours waiting to be seen.
Little Cope was hospitalized for 3 days. He was released and just had his 1-month regular well baby visit this week. His doctor says he has some residual congestion, but Cope has pretty much fully recovered from RSV. And that is welcome good news. But what's really going on here? Why is a well-known, common, and usually mild disease that just about everyone gets suddenly overwhelming America's pediatric hospitals? There are thousands of cases nationwide, stories in the headlines and in social media about kids getting sick and daycares closing. Pediatricians are calling the current RSV surge like March 2020 was for adults with COVID. But RSV is not a global pandemic. It is not a novel disease. So is this a story about a pathogen mutating and becoming more harmful? Or is it actually about our healthcare system and its inability to handle changes in diseases we already know about? Well, Dr. Meghan Bernier joins us. She's the medical director of the pediatric ICU at the Johns Hopkins Children's Center, and she joins us from Baltimore. Dr. Bernier, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
So I'd like to just start off with some basic but important education for all of us here on RSV. Can you tell me Are you seeing a surge of it at Hopkins?
We are. More cases, just like Caitlin said, patients waiting for beds. And in our region, too, we think of Baltimore sort of in between D.C. and Philadelphia, and this DMV mid-East Coast area is certainly having a rise in RSV cases earlier than normal, and it seems to be more than normal.
Earlier and more. Okay. So I want to find out why, but can you tell us some of the basics of the disease itself? What is it caused by?
So it's a virus, super common, circulates every year. Some places in the South where it's warm, Florida, it'll circulate all year round. Places that have more seasons, the Mid-Atlantic and the North, it's very seasonal. It's one of the main reasons for the common flu.
Okay.
You and I get it, and we're totally fine. Younger infants who've never seen RSV before, it's their first year of cold and flu season, they'll be more affected by it. The overwhelming majority of them are cranky, coughing, stuffy babies who maybe see their pediatrician once and do just fine. A smaller subset of them need to spend some time in an emergency room or in an inpatient floor. And an even smaller set of that smaller set require hospitalization in an ICU. And then unfortunately, as was in the introduction, a few children every year die from RSV.
Mm. But what you're describing, though, is what we already know and usually expect to see, that for the vast majority of children, especially children under five, even though there's that narrow band that can be very negatively and harmfully impacted by RSV, that most of the time it does. Am I right by saying it looks like it behaves kind of like the common cold?
Absolutely. And it is one of the ways for the common cold. It's one of the viruses that causes the common cold. But particularly in younger infants and those with chronic medical conditions, it can cause really some difficulty with breathing. It infects the lining of the airways, and it causes sloughing of those cells, and you get the distress that comes with that. You're already breathing through little tiny baby airways, and if they're filled with mucus that the babies can't mobilize that easily, it makes it even harder. So that's why you see the things like nasal flaring, retractions, tugging, like Caitlin said that her child had.
All signs that an infant is really working hard to breathe, essentially.
Exactly.
Okay. You know, I am going to get to an analysis about why so many more cases are ending up in the hospital or hospitals are being overwhelmed right now. But I want to help parents out a little bit here. So first of all, you know, what signs should they be looking for? Is there anything beyond that labored breathing? When should they go to the pediatrician? And I'm sure a lot of parents right now want to know, like, how can they prevent their child from getting it?
Absolutely. So we'll start at the beginning. And an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. RSV and a lot of the respiratory viruses are actually spread by droplets. So if someone coughs or sneezes, those larger droplets of mucus will have the active virus in them. So covering coughs, frequent washing of hands, and even washing of surfaces. We call those fomites in medicine, commonly used toys, cell phones, remote controls, countertops. RSV can live on those for some period of time. So it's important to keep those surfaces clean when you have either yourself sick or a child that's sick. Prevention in the form of staying up to date on recommended vaccinations, the flu vaccination, the COVID boosters. Anything you can do to prevent other illnesses is certainly warranted right now. And then if you do have a child that starts to fall ill, trying to keep them hydrated with water and Pedialyte and fluids of that sort, monitoring them and keeping them comfortable if they develop a fever and they're a little cranky with it, trying to give them fever-reducing medicines to help with that. Fevers make children breathe harder and work harder to breathe. So if you can take out that factor, appropriately using those medicines versus based on weight-based dosing. And then monitoring your child for difficulty breathing, nasal flaring, breathing faster than normal. There's recommended numbers based on the age of children. And then distress when they're sort of sucking in or pulling in with their in between their ribs or their bellies. and pre-educating yourself on what these look like. There's a lot of very reputable social media websites, the American Academy of Pediatricians, who can help educate families on what these signs and symptoms look like.
Yeah. So again, just to emphasize, most kids, the vast majority of kids are going to be okay. But in cases where that labored breathing is evident, mm-hmm. I mean, we heard Caitlin earlier say it was just a mere matter of hours, and from little Cope having that labored breathing to ending up in the emergency room. So, I mean, is it something that parents, if they see that, they should act very quickly?
They should. Babies, one of the great things about pediatrics is that the children are well until they are not. unlike you and I as adults, we kind of whittle with our illnesses. Children will hold on until the very end, playful, looking great 1 minute, and then being in desperate need of medical attention the next. And so at the first sign of an illness, giving your pediatrician just, you know, a phone call through their after hours line, telling them what's going on, they can give you education on what to look for. But then if those babies develop those signs and symptoms really quickly, you know, calling your, you know, local pediatrician for recommendations, or if you feel like you can't wait, presenting to the emergency room in the fastest way possible. And even though emergency rooms are full with patients right now, there's always a triage system available, and children who need care will receive care when they present for evaluation.
Okay. Well, today we're talking about RSV and why it seems America's pediatric hospitals are full, even possibly overwhelmed, with cases of very young children in a lot of distress from a virus that's been circulating for decades. So what's going on here? Is this about the virus or is it about our healthcare system? That's what we're going to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're trying to understand what's driving what seems to be a dramatic surge in RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, in very young children in the United States, and overwhelming pediatric hospitals and emergency rooms. I'm joined today by Dr. Megan Bernier. She's medical director of the pediatric ICU at the Johns Hopkins Children's Center, and she's with us from Baltimore. And Dr. Bernier, I have to say, I'm the mom of two. They're well out of their preschool years by a lot now. But when they were in preschool and when they were infants, I had never heard of RSV, not even a single time. I mean, obviously, I'm sure they got it, but it wasn't something that was in the, you know, in the information ecosystem for us. So has something changed about the pathogen itself that's driving these bigger numbers this year?
You know, I don't think so. I don't think anything has changed with RSV itself. I just think we have, a large cohort of children, sort of the four and unders, the three and unders, who during COVID times were more sheltered and didn't have exposure to the pathogen. And so they're just seeing their first couple of cases of it right now. And so instead of having just 1 year's generation of RSV naive patients, we have 3 years generations and 4 years generations of RSV naive patients. And so we're seeing children who are much older in older preschool, who've usually already had this illness, now getting it for the first time. Some of my friends with children, they're mentioning that this is their child is 3.5 years old and it's the first time they've ever had a fever, which in prior to 2020, you know, kids would have a cold a month. And so it's just, it's a different landscape right now.
And when you say RSV naive, it's because of lockdowns, because kids were out of daycare for a long time and schools. Be more specific about what you mean.
Yeah, exactly. So children, for lack of a better term, and most endearing as a pediatrician, are little petri dishes. They get together, they share their germs, they slobber on toys and share them with each other, and they pass around these very common illnesses, common colds to each other. And we just didn't have as much of that, you know. Not as many children were in daycare, not as many children were at playgroups, not as many children were at the, you know, community library reading hours. And so they just weren't around each other as much. There weren't as many adults interacting with younger children. And so it's just likely that although they are otherwise normal and healthy children, they just haven't been exposed to this virus yet. And we know the immune system works on repeat exposures to different illnesses. Mm. So the first time you're exposed to something, when you usually would have been exposed to it at 6 months, and now you're 3.5 years old, it's the first time you've seen it. So you're going to get ill from it.
I see. So basically, when you say different generations, you're saying that the cases that we would have seen in 2020, 2021, we didn't. But now we are, because children are delightfully slobbering all over each other again.
Exactly. And we know it was very interesting. In March and April of 2020, flu and RSV cases immediately dropped. And we generally see these here, at least in the Mid-Atlantic, well into April and May. In 2021, we still had some patients getting ill from it. It was still circulating in the community. We certainly had RSV admissions in the ICU. But now in the fall of 2022, it's just a massive increase in them. And I think when you take a small proportion of a larger number, you still have a large number of cases.
Right, right. Okay, so there is an actual uptick in the absolute number of children who have RSV right now. And I want to just back that up with what the CDC itself has said, because last Friday, CDC held a press call on RSV, and Dr. Jose Romero, who's the director of the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, says, yes, there is an increase in the number of cases at this time of year in particular, compared to recent years, but he also stresses that it was expected.
Mitigation efforts led up across the country during the pandemic, and as people begin to congregate more to stop wearing masks, it's not surprising to see this increase in respiratory virus circulation. You know, in the previous years, atypical presentations or atypical seasons due to mitigation against COVID left a large swath of the United States population uninfected. So we're seeing more RSV because in the past 2 years, we've not seen infections in children as we have previously. And so these children, if you will, need to become infected to move forward, because it's a disease very common in children. We're not seeing at this time more severe cases of disease. And so we will continue to monitor this over the upcoming weeks.
So that's Dr. Jose Romero, director of CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. And Dr. Bernier, just to be frank, I'm sure a lot of parents hear that and say, well, hooray, it's not unexpected, but still, kids are getting sick. The problem is that if it's not unexpected, why are hospitals overwhelmed right now?
Yeah. So regardless of what anyone says at the CDC or on NPR, you know, if it's your baby that's sick in front of you, it's the most precious and important thing to you. And so what's happened over the past couple of years, and this was pre-COVID, is that smaller community sites with wonderful pediatricians and wonderful staff who are experienced and capable of caring for children with RSV and other colds and flus, they've been slowly shutting down and whittling away. Pediatric care is just not as lucrative as adult care. And a hospital system looking at their bottom line may say, you know, there's another community hospital 10 miles away that can care for this. We're going to transition this pediatric unit into something else. And then when COVID happened, that potentially further escalated cases of hospitals closing pediatric units and, you know, seeing that they can transition them to adult COVID spaces and take care of patients. And these places haven't reopened. And so whereas we used to have a lot of smaller community hospitals that could care for 5 or 6 infants with RSV for a couple days, do a spectacular job at caring for them, we don't have those community pop-off sites anymore. So patients are limited in where they're able to go, and that means larger centers and larger academic centers and quaternary hospitals that, in addition to providing community pediatric care, asthma, dehydration, RSV, you know, they're providing open heart surgery and trauma care and chemotherapy and complex neonatal services for premature infants. And so children are still getting cancer and car accidents are still happening. And those patients need the quaternary care that places like Hopkins and Wake Med can provide. And then the babies with RSV who just need a couple days in the hospital also need to find some place to have care. And so it's balancing all of those demands on the system at once when there are simply less beds.
Mm. I'd like to put it more bluntly, Dr. Bernier. This is an indictment of the U.S. healthcare system yet again, right? Because from what I hear you saying is you started by saying pediatric care is not as lucrative as adult care. That's at the basis of what your analysis is it not?
I mean, absolutely. You can take it on a larger scale. A pediatrician in the community counseling a teenager on mental health, it simply gets reimbursed less than an orthopedic surgeon replacing that patient's grandmother's hip. And that's the healthcare system that we currently have. And this is now the repercussions of it. We have, you know, 3-week-olds and 4-week-olds with RSV who spend 24 hours or 36 hours in the emergency room waiting for an inpatient bed, and the EDs do the best they can, but, you know, they have stretchers in the emergency room. They don't have cribs. And so, you know, babies are propped up with pillows surrounding them, which we know is unsafe for them. But places are doing the best they can. But it does come down to that, you know, pediatric care isn't the moneymaker that adult care is. And any pediatrician will tell you that. Yeah. You know, you go into pediatrics to take care of children and their families, and that's why you do it.
So it's the kind of care that most often kids need that isn't as lucrative as doing 15 hip replacements a day. And also, it is part of the picture that many, many children in this country are covered under Medicaid, for example.
Yep, that too.
How does that play into the overall, like, financial picture you're talking about here?
It certainly does. Depending on how the government healthcare is in whatever state you're in, and reimbursement rates are different and they're generally less than a private insurance. Certainly health disparities come into, you know, reasons why certain populations of children are hospitalized more so than others. And so it's all a giant ball of string wound tightly together, and you can pluck out each string that you want, but the giant ball is still going to be there. And so it is a commentary on American healthcare and the system that we have found ourselves practicing in.
So we have the reduction in access to pediatric emergency care in community hospitals in rural areas, but also just the fundamental sort of economics of how hospitals are run. Even world-class places like where you work at Johns Hopkins, for example. I mean, we've had conversations with, you know, former hospital CEOs, one of them who likened a hospital system to an airline where the goal was just to keep the beds full all the time because empty beds weren't making money. So, I mean, at Hopkins Children's Center, even in a normal non-RSV surge year, is the place basically always at capacity by design?
Not necessarily by design, okay. But I would say by need. We generally run occupancies of 90 to 95% all the time. There is always a predicted lull. It happens right after Memorial Day into the beginning of June. Kids aren't out of school yet getting their summer surgeries, and trauma season hasn't picked up yet, and the viral season is coming to a dwindles. But really those 2 weeks, end of May, beginning of June, are really the only time we're less than 90, 95% capacity. And I wouldn't say it's necessarily by design, but it is just how our hospital here is with the capacity that we have. and the demand for the beds that we have.
I see. Well, so then what are you doing now? I mean, how is a place like Hopkins handling this rise in the number of RSV cases? I hear that you have pediatric tents set up?
So we have either repurposed space or increased space, and we can start with what we've done in our emergency room space. We used to have a COVID tent for adults. And as it's able to be staffed, they are using it for respiratory patients, not patients who are very ill and needing admission, but patients who need to be evaluated and treated and given recommendations and can be discharged after a little bit of an observation time. Our emergency department is expanding care when they can and increasing teams to take care of patients who are admitted to the hospital, but not yet in a hospital bed. They're called boarders. That's the colloquial term that we use.
Mm.
And then on our inpatient floors and our outpatient clinics, places are stretching the times that they're open. Some of our subspecialty clinics are staying open later in the evening so that they can care for patients who may get care in the ED or in an inpatient floor for a few hours. Instead, they're trying to do as much as they can in the outpatient space to save those inpatient beds for children who need it. And then in our ICU, we've expanded capacity in beds by incrementally opening beds and adjusting the models of how we provide care with nurses. We can't go talking about the healthcare system in America without talking about the healthcare worker shortage.
Of course. Well, actually, can you hold that thought? Because I've,
absolutely.
I wanted to turn right to that with the help of another mom who recently had to go to the hospital because of RSV. We talked to her name. Her name is Lauren Zaleski, and she's in Chicago. She's got two kids, a 2-year-old girl named Claire and a 17-month-old named Jack. And when Jack was just 7 weeks old, he was hospitalized with RSV for about a week. Last week, he was hospitalized again for RSV, and Lauren told us that this time was just as scary, but for different reasons.
Knowing how much stress the hospital system was under and knowing that it was understaffed, I do feel like that heightened my anxiety even more. So this past time around with Jack, we were there for 2 nights. I, you know, slept on the little couch next to him. But I didn't sleep because I'm watching the monitor. I'm hearing the beats when, you know, his oxygen dips too low and alarms go off. And I had the very real fear of, is anybody paying attention to this? Is there, you know, someone at the nurse's station that knows this is happening right now? Do I put my shoes on and go ask? Do I press the button? You know, and all you want is the right care for your kid at that point. And so that line between having faith and trust in the doctors and nurses who I know are working so hard and doing the very best they can, but also understanding the very real limitations of how things are right now was extra scary.
So that's Lauren Zaleski in Chicago, a mom in Chicago. Dr. Bernier, give us your view of how much the staffing shortages and healthcare worker shortages are playing a role here.
They're certainly not helping and exacerbating. Healthcare worker shortages were present prior to COVID. The largest and most visible is in bedside nursing, but that's not the whole story. It's also in environmental workers, it's in pharmacies, technicians who prepare medicines, it's in, you know, physicians, but it all coalesces together where if we don't have the staff to care for a bed, then that bed goes unfilled with a patient. At Hopkins, we take patient safety is of utmost importance, and so we will stretch our staff as much as is safely possible. But we're not going to put our staff in a dangerous situation, and we're not going to put the patients in a dangerous situation. And so we see that at the bedside. You know, we have had some changing of ratios of nurse to patient care. We've had some additional help with acute care nurses who are helping out in the pediatric ICU to try to extend the number of patients that we can safely care for. But it's all around. It's our respiratory therapists. Instead of having a 6 or 7 patient assignment, they're now having an 8 or 9 patient assignment. So not unsafe, but stretched from what they're used to. our trainees and our frontline medical providers who provide, you know, the direct care to the patients in the ICU may take care of 6 or 7 patients, and now they're taking care of 8 or 9 patients. Mm. And so we stretch and push people, but when we start to hear that it's too much, then we back off, because the most important patient is the patient that's in the bed and the safety of that patient and the quality of care that we provide them.
Well, Dr. Megan Bernier, hang on for just a second. We're going to talk more when we come back about what this says about the healthcare system, ways we can improve it, and also whether there are vaccine fixes for RSV as well. So that'll be what we talk about in just a minute. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I want to let you know what we're working on for tomorrow's show, because I want your input on it. We're going to be talking with scholar Richard Reeves. He's written a book about the prospect of boys and men in the United States, especially, or actually even around the world, but focusing here on the United States in the past couple of decades, because he's seeing boys struggling in schools more than girls, men with lower educational attainment relevant to women, higher levels of unemployment, more drug overdoses, and growing toxic masculinity. And he's got some ideas about how to fix what he calls male malaise in the modern world. So fathers, sons, mothers, friends, sisters, brothers, we want to hear from you. For example, if you're a parent of a son and a daughter, do you see a difference in how they're doing in school? Or what's the job market been like for you guys? How do you feel about what's going on with drug overdoses in your community? What is the plight of boys and men, if anything? Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Really want to hear your stories for this hour we're doing tomorrow. Today we are focusing on RSV and the rise of cases in young American children that are ending up in pediatric emergency rooms across the country and overwhelming those hospitals. It's both a story about RSV as a disease, but also about decisions we've made for decades in the American healthcare system as well. Dr. Megan Bernier joins us. She's the medical director of the pediatric ICU at Johns Hopkins Children's Center. And joining us now is Professor Saad Omer. He is the director of the Yale Institute for Global Health and an infectious disease epidemiologist as well. Professor Omer, welcome to you.
Good to be here.
So you've been hearing Dr. Bernier talk to us about what she's seeing, not only this year, but overall in changes in pediatric care in this country. Do you think that some of these places could have or should have been better prepared for an RSV surge?
Look, some of these are systemic issues that require long-term solutions. So, of course, as a country, we should be better prepared for these annual surges, and especially when these kinds of surges of viral illnesses are more severe in certain years. However, for this particular virus, there was work. There was academic work, and there was work that was shared in advance of this surge that suggested and that kind of predicted that for a couple of years we'll see these abnormal rates or higher than usual rates of respiratory illnesses like RSV, even influenza. The influenza season peaks in the U.S. in late January and February, depending on your location. And so because of the reasons that were discussed earlier, that kids did not see these sort of common viruses for a couple of years, we were expecting these kinds of surges. So that was out there. And I wish we had paid attention to that science a little bit more as a country, as a health system, to better plan for this.
Well, so this is actually quite heartening, right? So it's completely unlike COVID in that case, right? Because we could see it coming. We understand the pathogen. We know its dynamics as a disease as it spreads. So the limitation there is, even with the knowledge, the limitation is in the American healthcare system as it currently exists, is it not? Because if it's very difficult to change a system that's been, according to Dr. Bernier, sort of retracting in terms of available pediatric emergency care in a lot of places in this country, you can't, even if you know something's coming down the line in a couple of months, it's hard to change that system, is it not?
Yeah. So as I said, there are certain things that are harder to change. But there are a few things that are we can prepare for, and as going back to the science around this, there was, for example, a paper, not in an obscure journal. It was in Science, one of the major scientific journals, by a couple of colleagues from Emory University, that showed that some of these viruses will go up. And respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, was one of them. So even with the shortcomings of our healthcare system, there were a few things we could have done a little bit better to prepare the health systems, the providers, the parents, by just looking at the science that was telling us that these kinds of things are to be expected for the next couple of years.
So what were those things that we could have done?
Well, first of all, making sure that hospitals are better prepared. They have a bit of a head start in terms of preparing for these surges, to make sure that there is a public information campaign, rather than just going on sort of primetime TV and talking about it occasionally about something like this, a more concerted old school public health campaign that informs parents that the next couple of years will be a little bit bumpy, what to expect, what to do about it, and to clearly communicate around it. And so there are a few things that are old school public health that could still have been done.
Okay, so point taken about the importance of effective old school public health communication. It does kind of dishearten me a little bit that we still haven't learned that lesson even after almost 3 years of COVID. But you said hospitals could have been prepared a little bit more. I want to focus on that. I'm going to push on that more because that seems to be the Sisyphean boulder that's going to be tough to move here. So let me give you an example. We talked to Karen Just. She's an ICU nurse at Johns Hopkins Children's Center in Baltimore, where Dr. Bernier works. And Karen told me that the surge in RSV is nothing new. She's seen, as a nurse, she's seen cases like this annually, for example, with the flu. But what has changed, again, this is where we're getting to the structural and economic decisions that now underlie our healthcare system. Karen says it's the staffing charged with managing these surges. And she says since the start of the COVID pandemic, as we've talked about, they've lost nearly half of their nursing staff, their permanent full-time nursing staff. That hole has been replaced by supplemental staff because they can't retain full-time nurses. Meaning, right now, at least a quarter of the nursing staff at Hopkins Children's Center are travel or supplemental nurses.
Travel nurses can make upwards of $150 an hour through contracts with our hospital. You know, the pediatric ICU at Hopkins has job postings for travel nurses to work 3 12-hour day shifts, and they make upwards of $5,000 a week. And most of us make $32 to $34 an hour. When you do that math, it's really, really significant. And, you know, of course, there are other factors. A lot of people will say there are other factors involved in retention, but the reality is that your salary, your base rate, is a direct representation of the value that your institution places on you as a nurse and your institutional knowledge. And I think that is a huge component of it.
And one of the things that's driving that big pay difference is that hospitals don't have to pay for the benefits that the travel nurses get. That comes through the travel nurses company that they work for here. But Dr. Bernier, respond to what Karen said about some, you know, again, the sort of long-term changes in how hospitals are being staffed.
It is true. I work daily with Karen, so I know her quite well. There has been a shift in staffing in ICUs. Travel nurses are nothing new. They've always been seen as supplemental staff. You generally have to have a good period of time underneath your belt, and then you can go off and staff other units who need help. And so generally these people dive right in and take over anything that's asked of them. And so some will argue that that attitude of diving in, going into the unknown and taking care of whatever's thrown at you is, you know, recuperated with larger sums of money and payment for it. But as the COVID pandemic continued on and the after COVID pandemic period, travel nursing has been seen as a lucrative way for nurses who are maybe not tied down. They're younger, they have experience. They maybe don't have a spouse or a partner or children who are tied to a school, and an ability to go around the country and see different parts of it and help out different ICUs. And so it's maybe a quick fix to a long-term problem. But keeping our own staff that we love and adore and enjoy working with every day, like Karen, reinvesting in them and showing them gratitude and thanks for sticking with it at their home institutions is part of it and part of the retention. And I mean, I don't work on a large scale at our institution and in sort of the higher up offices of the directors of things. I'm just a lowly ICU doc. And so, you know, what I do is I thank the people that I work with, and we tussle and get emotional and get tired. But at the end of the day, it comes down to appreciating the people who are there in the thick of it with you at 2:30 in the morning, trying to save a really sick kid's life.
Yeah. Dr. Bernier, I'm glad you said that, because to make it clear, I'm not putting you on the hook for the the C-suite level decisions made at any major hospital in the United States. So I'm glad you said that. It's just, you know, given the fact that you're walking those same halls with the nurses, I wanted to get your take on that picture when it comes to sort of structural changes here. But Professor Omer, there's also, in terms of preparedness moving forward, if there's going to be a couple of rocky years here, as you said, that parents should be aware of, that brings up the question of vaccination, right? Because from what I understand, there was some kind of effort, in the 60s to create an RSV vaccine, but that backfired. So we don't have an RSV vaccine right now. Is that correct?
Yeah, the initial efforts that were conducted in the late 60s were targeting children directly. And those efforts were not successful. And not only that they were not successful, they set back the whole field for several decades. Now we have good news. And the good news is that there are at least two vaccines with large efficacy trial data that are really promising and could be approved, could be licensed in the near future, hopefully within the next year, for the two highest risk populations. So the first high risk population that folks are targeting is older individuals. The other one is young infants, so infants who are younger than 3 months or 6 months. But rather than vaccinating them directly, it is using an interesting strategy, which is to vaccinate their mothers and to use the natural phenomenon of antibody transfer from mothers to infants to protect these little babies. And there are several reasons that I'm not going to go into where it's not suitable to vaccinate really young children, primarily because, you know, just to summarize that part, primarily because they don't mount effective, desirable response to this virus. But there are other reasons as well. So therefore, now to bypass all that whole immunological challenge, The studies were done in pregnant women, and that part of the vaccine strategy also looks promising.
Mm. So, but that still seems to be a little ways away because it has to go through the approval process. But we have Thanksgiving and the end of year holidays upon us now, where ideally families and friends get together more. Are we likely to see a continuing rise in the number of cases, Professor Omer?
Unfortunately, yes. In fact, the way the pattern has been for respiratory syncytial virus for ages, it is that it starts in the south, usually in the U.S., or there is sometimes year-round circulation beyond the usual respiratory season. And then it goes up the coast. So coastal areas get it first, and then it goes inland. And so it's a rough pattern, and that's what we are likely to see. And several areas are likely to see surges as we get more colder weather and we have the holidays where there's intergenerational mixing. And so therefore, unfortunately, we will continue to see a surge in RSV cases. It is likely to be heterogeneous regionally. So instead of a national surge, we are likely to see these regional surges in RSV cases and unfortunately, hospitalization that goes with it.
Mm. Well, Dr. Bernier, just we're rounding towards the end of the conversation today, and I keep thinking about how, you know, you described changes in pediatric care nationwide over the past many years. Now, on the one hand, in a for-profit healthcare system like we have, across the country, perhaps it's unreasonable to expect a lot of excess capacity, right, in pediatric care. I don't necessarily like saying that, but that's maybe the operational presumption we need to work with here. But nevertheless, it also sounds like the way pediatric care has been going, that it is ill-equipped to handle even minor surges in known diseases. So what would you like to see change? Or is this kind of our new normal that places that can are just going to have to put up tents anytime there's an uptick in some kind of disease for kids?
No, I'd say I don't think anyone wants this to be the new normal. But I think what hopefully COVID has taught us, and maybe what this will teach us, is nimbleness in our healthcare system and flexibility in our healthcare system, and, you know, better regionalization of our healthcare system, where even though Hospital A and Hospital B are within different hospital systems, they can still work together, share beds, swap patients. Here in Maryland, that would be sort of the Hopkins system and the University of Maryland system working together. So I hope that we just have a broader flexibility and more nimbleness in our system to care for these patients who need the help when they need it.
Well, Dr. Megan Bernier, she's medical director of the pediatric ICU at the Johns Hopkins Children's Center in Baltimore. Dr. Bernier, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Professor Saad Omer, infectious disease epidemiologist and director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. Professor Omer, it was a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.